This is Laura Deirdre with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Jennifer Alvey, Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at Indiana University Health. Jennifer, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you, Laura.
Now, can we talk about you and your path to CFO of one of the great health systems in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually grew up as a farm kid in southern Indiana, so being able to serve as a CFO for the largest health system in the state that has a vision to make Indiana one of the nation's healthiest states still inspires me every day. I actually went to IU and went to become an accountant. I stayed there to work in accounting, and I became a CPA. Then I decided to go back to law school again at Indiana University. And I ended up practicing law at Ice Miller as bond counsel for higher ed and healthcare in downtown Indianapolis. I got lucky. I ended up being able to serve under Governor Mitch Daniels as the public finance director for the state of Indiana. And then from there, I moved over to IU Health to start my career in healthcare. Actually get to serve as treasurer and then vice president of rev cycle. And then I had a really cool opportunity to become the CFO for the IU Health system. And I very much still enjoy working with my colleagues and our exec team and for our CEO, Dennis Murphy.
Oh, fascinating. Well, what was it like making that transition from the public sector, you know, working in the state and then coming to the health system? What were you able to bring to that? And was there anything that surprised you?
Yeah, that is a great question. So, you know, I would say there are actually a lot of similarities, actually in all three of my roles, you know, having worked at IU for a public higher ed institution, and then working for the state that, you know, is there to serve the citizens of the state and try to provide great services at the lowest cost. I felt very similar, and that was kind of part of my calling coming into healthcare, wanting to come into healthcare, trying to then get care to be more affordable, and then being able to be part of just such a really cool place that has all these great providers and cutting edge medicine, you know, with our academic health center. So that part was really neat and enjoyable and expected. The part that I would say was not expected, honestly, was the complexity of revenue in a healthcare system. I mean, I didn't even understand when I first came here, like how the payers worked. I really kind of thought patients just paid for all the health care. And so understanding things such as charge master and charges and prices and CPT codes and DRGs, it was just a lot more complicated than I ever expected. So it's been a daunting challenge since then to try to really turn things around and get our price affordability plan in place.
Got it. Wow, that's so interesting to hear. And, you know, since then, since you've come into Indiana University Health, what do you see as like one of your biggest wins or accomplishments that you've been able to make during that time?
Well, so honestly, I would say several years ago, when both at the federal level and the state level, people started talking about price transparency and publishing our prices, it really kind of dawned on us, hey, there is so much complexity. We've got a lot of work to do before we feel really good about being able to be transparent on our prices and making it easy for people to understand. I mean, there's like 50,000 lines in our charge master. And so we knew we were going to have to publish all that. So we've been on a multi-year journey, really starting more from the pricing transparency aspect. And I would say we built this price estimation tool. I think we did it in like 2014 was like the first time we were using it in 2015. And now today, I feel like we have the best systems in the nation that can estimate what your costs are going to be out of pocket based on what your insurance deductible is at the time upfront before you get the service. And you can do that in many ways. And we have hundreds of thousands of those that we do each year. And this year, we actually started proactively pushing it. So at the time you schedule, you'll actually get that price estimate up front because we think it's really important that you know that.
That's fascinating. Wow, what a great accomplishment. How forward thinking on your part in the system to put that in place.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I also want to talk to you about managing P&L and freezing prices. while trying to be optimally staffed. How have you been able to accomplish both? I understand that's something that you've been able to do. And so I wanted to just get your thoughts on that from that perspective.
Yeah. So actually, if I could, I'd like to explain what our pricing care affordability strategy actually is. It's been written many different ways in the press. And what it really is a multi-year plan that when you account for all the payers and services, it will essentially hold our revenue that we receive from price increases flat year over year. And so in that same time period, it'll bring more than $1 billion in savings for healthcare consumers after you factor in inflation. And we've committed to getting our commercial prices to national parity by the end of 2025. So kind of to your point about how can we do that while trying to be optimally staffed, we're creating an internal constraint on our system to have to get more efficient because we are holding that flat. And boy, is that a lot harder to accomplish in the current workforce environment. So it's a great question. I mean, we actually just posted our public filing for last year, and our labor went up 3 times its normal amount last year, and we expect similar pressures this year. And you know, adequate staffing will be a higher expense for us, but it really can assist our price affordability plan by allowing us to reduce the high cost of traveling nurses, catching up on carrying out thousands of elective surgeries and procedures that were postponed during the pandemic. Another thing that will help us is reducing the cost of common services, which are a key part of our affordability plan. So it will allow IU Health to be more competitive against a growing number of for-profit companies trying to expand into areas like radiology services, infusion, specialty services that will provide us more volume. And if I could just for a minute, you know, speaking of this area, I mean, we've made a commitment to reduce our prices to the national average by the end of 25, but we really need to do this in a responsible way to maintain the quality of care. So that includes us working with other providers and the state to simultaneously move Indiana closer to the national average in public health spending, cigarette taxes, value-based care model payments, and other health metrics. And really making healthcare more affordable is making sure that Hoosiers have ready access to care. So if we can accomplish this and help make Indiana healthier, along with a number of other things, the public, including employers, are expecting and demanding more affordable health care costs. We understand this, and we really just help plan to lead the way on that.
Got it. That's fascinating to hear, you know, and it's just really interesting to know from the public health perspective, as well as how you're thinking about labor and labor cost increases and making things more efficient and effective. From your perspective, when you're looking at, you know, making sure all of that is square on your budget and in the bottom line, you know, are there any other things that, you know, you're seeing more immediately that'll have to be kind of red flagged as having to do more sooner? And then, you know, looking long term, how are you setting yourself up for success and balancing the short and long term as well?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. As we evaluate, you know, where to do the appropriate price reductions, it's always with an eye to ensure we're still covering our costs when considering all payers. So our intent is to deliver long-term sustainable price improvements that are market competitive, but that they also reflect true costs. So 2 years into our plan, we haven't had a conflict between competitive pricing and our cost to deliver services, but we'll tackle that, you know, if that comes up. But I would just say over the long term, we'll be more successful as we eliminate waste, we deliver new innovative care models, you know, we use technology to help automate the types of things that are non-value add, and really also just expanding our market share. So there's just a lot of work to be done, but I really think as we continue to get more agile and, you know, on the other side of COVID, we'll be able to accomplish this work, but it won't be easy. And we want to just make sure that we're balancing the quality of care and we're not sacrificing our ability to respond in a time like a pandemic and be able to serve the public as we need to.
Got it. That makes sense. Thank you so much for going through that with us. Now, before we wrap up our conversation, I wanted to ask, what are three pieces of advice that you would give to emerging leaders today?
So first is something that I learned later in my career, and I wish I had learned earlier. So I tell anyone this, like a young leader who's starting out their career, which is use your ears and your eyes before you use your mouth. So listening and observing and then asking the right questions before you formulate your opinions will help you to become a better leader and a more collaborative partner. So that would probably be my first one. That's pretty basic. We all should know, but we forget often. And then a second one that I think is really important, has been a big motto of mine for a long time, is not to be afraid to make mistakes and fail. And it's better to try things and iterate on how to get it right instead of going into analysis paralysis. It's also very important to consider how you react to mistakes as a leader, so you create an innovative environment versus one that has a fear of failure. And so I just think that that is a really important thing to do as a leader, both yourself, which we learned a lot during the pandemic. We didn't really have a choice, right? We were just going in and trying things, and some we were getting right and some we weren't. And if we didn't, we'd immediately tweak it and we'd just keep going. And so I think that actually the pandemic helped accelerate that. And then the third is actually just something I heard the other day. I was driving into work and listening to Cy Wakeman's No Ego, which she actually wrote before the pandemic. But she said something along the lines of, your circumstances are not the reason you can't succeed. They're the reality in which you must succeed. And it applies so well now with COVID, with so many people saying we can't do that because of COVID, or we didn't get that done because of COVID. Well, now we're in year three of a pandemic, and we need to adapt to approach it as part of our new circumstances that are the reality in which we must succeed. So building processes and structures that create agility are more important now than ever. And that's the advice I'd give.
I love that. Thank you, Jennifer, so much for joining the podcast today. This has been a really fantastic discussion, and I look forward to connecting with you again soon.
Yeah, thank you.